This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
This is Fierce Light, where spirit meets action. Part of the Scared Sacred Project. www.scaredsacred.org. Breathe in suffering. Breathe out compassion. Hello, this is Velcro Ripper, and welcome to Fierce Light. Sorry, it's been a bit of an absence there. I've been on the road quite a bit and haven't quite got to doing the latest version. Right now I'm in Australia, and last week I had the pleasure of interviewing the co-originator of permaculture, David Holmgren, and spending the weekend at his sustainable permaculture farm, guests of David and his partner Sue, and their son, Oliver, just outside of Melbourne, Australia. He's a really inspiring example of spirit in action. Although he's an atheist, which makes it particularly interesting to me. He has a scientific and ecological relationship to spirit. If you take the definition, which I've become increasingly fond of, that perhaps an understanding of spirituality is an understanding of interconnectedness, then certainly. David and his work in permaculture could be described as being deeply spiritual. It's work founded in an understanding of systems theory, interconnected systems, both ecological and increasingly cultural or societal, as opposed to the reductionist thinking of modern science, although that's increasingly being called into question by a growing body of scientists, particularly in the field of physics, but also in the field of systems ecology, for example. David's recently published a book, self-published as a matter of fact, published a book called Permaculture, Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability, which asks the questions, do mainstream concepts of sustainability dodge the critical issue of global energy peak? And are there ways to live within nature's limits while providing a secure future for our children and justice for everyone? In the book, David Holmgren uses permaculture principles as a framework for an empowering but challenging vision of creative adaptation to a world of energy descent. Like many people, David believes that we're going to be coming into a time of peak oil, where the cheap energy bubble is going to burst, and we're really going to have to re-envision the way we live in a sustainable way. But as David says, he's interested in actually in going beyond sustainability. David co-founded permaculture with Bill Mollison back in the 70s, and for the last 25 years, it's grown into a global movement, which has taken root all over the world, quite literally, and has been really an important force in changing our relationship to the planet. So here's David Holmgren speaking from Mayadora, his permaculture farm in the town of Hepburn Springs.
In its simplest, permaculture is really a design system for sustainable living and for sustainable land use. So it's both about the way we use natural resources through agriculture, gardening, forestry, but it's also the way we live and about redesigning all of those things around sustainability principles. But it actually predates, in a historical sense, most of the modern sustainability concepts which emerged in the 1980s. It involves fairly fundamental principles of how we shift society and everything we do to something which is in keeping with the way nature works. Those general abstract ideas have been applied in a very concrete, practical way through projects which are life-changing for the people involved and actually deal with the practical issues of provision of fresh and safe water, shelter, food supply, the basic human material needs. And that ideas have actually been extended not just through publication of books and other media, but through a teaching system which has gone around the world called the Permaculture Design Course, which has been an intensive training in permaculture ideas that's now spread to hundreds of countries around the world. Permaculture as an environmental concept is not just scientific ideas. It does have a connection to ideas of deep ecology, of indigenous notions, of our connection to nature. And In permaculture, those rest really on three essential ethics that we'd see as universal, because we can see them in all traditional cultures: a place of care of the earth, care of people, and some notion of fair share, of redistribution of surplus and limits to how much we need, that there's nature is both abundant and sets limits, and that is encompassed in the ethic of fair share. So we wouldn't see that those are unique to permaculture. They're really a restatement of ideas that are universal in traditional cultures. And in the modern intentional communities movement that's developed in the Western world over the last 100 years of communities where people are in some way trying to recreate these connections. Beyond that foundation, we see that there are design principles that can be applied in any situation, from the city to the country, from the subarctic to the tropics, from our personal life to how we design and manage whole landscapes. Beyond those design principles, there are many diverse strategies and techniques which will be completely different in different situations. So those universal design principles are articulated in different ways, but often as simple statements like produce no waste, the idea that nothing is really a waste, it's the food for something else. This idea that in nature everything goes round in cycles. So rather than everything being just having inputs and outputs, and that outputs is largely waste, that we actually redevelop everything we do as cycles. So there is no waste. Some of those ideas are quite familiar to people through other environmental concepts. Similarly, the principle of use and value diversity. People now understand the ideas that biodiversity has value in itself. That's very fundamental to permaculture, but not just as biodiversity, the diversity of different behaviours, that the complementarity of different ways of doing things, rather than the all the eggs in one basket, the monoculture, and especially as Vandana Shiva said, the monoculture of mind, which underlies the monoculture of agriculture. So permaculture design in the 1970s was sort of really articulating a different way, initially, of agriculture, how we actually get our needs from nature, moving away from monoculture to diversity. But there are many other, there are 12 design principles in all. And the first is actually observe and interact. And it's an example of how these principles are necessary to re-educate ourselves or take away the dysfunctional education that we've gained through industrial culture. And one of those is the idea that everything we know must be poured into our heads through education, that all our knowledge of things comes from secondary sources, whereas permaculture is rooted in the idea that nature is the great textbook and that we can learn from constant observation and improve our observation all the time. But we can't just sit and observe in this illusion that we are separate from what we observe. We are actually engaged, so we have to do something. So it's observe and interact, and of course that's a constant process, and it's quite difficult often for people brought up in a world through compulsory education, through university, to be reminded that we can actually observe and gain knowledge directly, and that it is really the great source book for permaculture design. Within that principle, there's a whole lot of ideas that that have become like permaculture sayings. Perhaps the classic one is the problem is the solution. So that when we look at a problem and get fixated on how do we get rid of this pest or how do we stop something happening, that if we can stand back from it and look at it in a new way, sometimes we can see that in fact this is a message that we can learn from to do something in a different way. Of course, the classic one is pest plants and animals that are actually in fact resources that can be seen in another way, and we can learn how to use them, and in that process of using them we help bring them back into balance. But so there are many of these permaculture sayings which I would sort of broadly put under this principle of observe and interact, that a lot of the way we think about things actually structures what we are seeing, and to change and open up to new possibilities is more important than in fact all of the secondary sources of information that come through books, through teaching, through direct formal learning. Of course, both are useful. So we see these principles definitely apply in the way we garden, the way we farm land, the way we build a house, the way we organise our household, the way we behave as individuals, and the way we organise community structures, right through to economic systems of how we trade in communities, how we govern ourselves. So the scope of those principles is really universal, but the starting point for permaculture is that these principles come from understanding how these principles apply in nature. So we see that they are design principles in nature, and we can see how they've been design principles in sustainable cultures before modernity, in some unconscious or ways or ways that were articulated differently in the past, but bringing them to a conscious, clear way of thinking that can act as an antidote to so many of the Trojan horses in our thinking that are taking us in the wrong direction through the culture which has emerged that some people call it industrialization, globalism, modernity, that although we've gained enormous benefits from these developments, they are completely unsuited to the future that we face.
Continuing in that vein, you're talking about society and modernity. Maybe you can talk a little bit about addiction and what your concept of addiction is.
Part of the problem with modernity is really the problem of affluence, that we've become so successful at providing all of the things that people need. And there's been many analyses from Galbraith's The Affluent Society that what happens after people have what they need, there's been this creation of constant new consumer need, which has driven economic growth, but in a psychosocial sense is really quite analogous to drug addiction. And of course we now have the President of the United States actually using the A word, addiction, to describe the relationship to oil. So this process over the last 20 years perhaps of realising that the psychology of addiction, and gradually as people have become more aware of what are the nature of mostly pharmacological addiction to drugs and other substances, that this way of understanding actually can explain a lot of the things we see in society. And permaculture is in some ways working in two different realms. One, to address basic human need. In many very poor places of the world, how can people have safe drinking water collected off the roof? How can they grow some food to provide basic nutrition that they're not getting? But it's also working, if you like, with the global middle class, saying, how can we feel comfortable about living in a simpler way and get past our addictions. And that is as difficult a design process as the how do we provide for basic needs. In some ways, it's arguably a more difficult problem, especially if that addiction is still relatively comfortable, that the adverse effects of the addictive processes have been pushed to elsewhere in the world, so people are not experiencing the full consequences of addiction. Back in 93, I wrote a paper for a permaculture conference called Permaculture as Aid for the North, around this idea that permaculture was some sort of gentle way that we can positively disconnect from these driving needs that are destroying the planet. So I think, obviously, addiction to commuting, to travelling, addiction to shopping, addiction to television, all of these behaviours which actually drive a lot of the unsustainable economic and political processes in the world.
I mean, I see addictive behaviour in my own life, and I kind of spot it, come to identify it, but I can't always break it. Do you have any suggestions as to how we can break these addictive behaviours?
Yeah, well, I think part of the strength of permaculture has been the idea that we can actually redesign our immediate environment and start providing for some of our needs in ways that allow us to reduce our dependence on current addictions. For example, permaculture gardens that have a huge diversity and variety of produce is something that's relatively attractive to people, the idea of eating out of the garden. And that ability to provide that variety is partly to help wean the person used to the fridge and supermarket culture, which has only really developed in very recent generations, the idea that there is this limitless supply of things year round on a constant drip feed, when of course living within nature's rhythm is in reality a huge challenge of eating seasonally, of limited array of things. But by good design, we can actually make that more attractive, more possible, as a sort of a transitionary step to, if you like, a post-industrial sort of peasanthood, which is in reality the future of the world when we look to what future generations will be dealing with. They will be dealing with far less resources, far less energy than what we are, and permaculture is design is predicated around the fact that the modern ways of living are really just a historical phase of the second half of the 20th century, and they really don't have a lot of future at all in the 21st century. So for ourselves, we find that lifestyle where we live from the garden, work from home, working without the constant input of mainstream media, that those things that are usual, consistent things in people's lives has been a process of gradual weaning or gradual reduction and finding other things that satisfy those needs. But I don't think there's any easy answer to that question, and certainly there's no point in sort of moral injunctions about how people should deal with addiction. We know from pharmacological addiction that doesn't work, and it must come from a place of where people want to change, and there's some small steps that can be made towards that. Perhaps for the mass of people, it's only when the consequences of that addiction become really untenable that people are forced to change. So I think there's many different pathways, and we can think of the term cold turkey or walking through the valley of death, that, you know, there are many quite extreme pathways to getting beyond addiction. But I think permaculture solutions have been developed around the idea that this is a positive way to live. It's not just this is what we need to do for the sake of the planet, or this is what we need to do because the way we are living is unjust to other people. The realization that it actually hasn't been very good for ourselves either.
Having seen people who are addicted, pharmacologically addicted, counselors will say at a certain point, actually, don't give them food. At this point you can't support them, because the only way you're going to be able to support them is that they completely crash and they realize the effects. And do you think that could be happening in the world, that we could be heading for some form of a crash?
Well, I think that's definitely the case, and it will be multi-level and in all different ways, because of course we've got, it's wrong to just see that we have individual addiction in a psychological way, because we have systemic addiction, you know, the addiction to constant growth in the money supply to sustain the whole basis of the current economy, that it's actually not possible to just say, well, can't we just sort of keep this at the level it is? No, it must grow, because the system is actually addicted to that constant growth. And so we are facing manifold hazards that almost inevitably are going to lead to the withdrawal of the drip feed supply, the withdrawal of the standard assumption that electricity just flows through the wires reliably, that water flows through the pipes, that the food supply in the supermarket is a constant, uninterrupted supply, most definitely. And of course, a lot of those events will be portrayed as the results of great struggles of good and evil, of bad perpetrators and acts of God and all sorts of other great political and social processes. But in reality, they are the structural consequences of our unsustainable systems. They are inevitable. But now, as they come to reality, as throughout human history, they will tend to be experienced as great political and social upheavals rather than environmental problems. And it's interesting how environmentalists have often thought, when will environmental issues become the central issue? And in a way, they never do, because they become expressed in social and political processes, social and political issues. So I think we are looking at very severe crises. And a lot of those are sort of, they are severe in the way people will experience of them. But if we look back, if we looked with this perspective of our grandparents, they might be not real problems at all. Many people would find it extremely difficult if they, if the cost of fuel was such that they couldn't maintain their current levels of mobility. As I said, the addiction to food habits. But if we go back a few generations, people would say, well, that was not such a problem. That was an easy solution. So I think part of the problem is the perception that these things are terrible. The idea that people would be forced to rip up their lawns in suburbia and grow fruit and vegetables because the supply in the supermarket was both very expensive and unreliable because of long distance transport costs. Many people would see this as the end of the world, whereas in fact it's really just a life which until recently was quite normal and everywhere. So I think the perception about crisis is both is an interesting one, because there is no doubt we are facing massive structural crises, but also our perception of those in the affluent world has been sort of over ramped up, and in fact the adaptive possibilities are everywhere, and a lot of these permaculture solutions are very simple ones rather than the very complex ideas. Perhaps the simplest is how we can work out not to do something at all, rather than getting some new source of it, and whether that's more water or more energy or other resources, we can just work out how not to use that. And the opportunities to do that are very great. Perhaps the other aspect that people often assume that because we're used to this large, centralized, huge systems, that they will provide, that or they should do something, whereas the world we're coming to is a world of where we will have to do something, and that is both as an individual and in community, that we'll have to organise with other people to provide for needs. And a lot of those solutions are actually at a level that people can make the changes, but corporations and government can't, because the solutions are small, almost like crumbs on the floor.
What do you mean by the phrase top-down, bottom-up?
Well, I think a lot of the processes in our society work automatically, that we act top-down. It's the sort of the idea that you get to the people who've got the levers of power, and you pull those levers and you make things happen. And because those levers have so much influence, a lot happens. This really comes from the old king model, you know, the king's at the top and he pulls the levers of power, and the peasants, sort of, it affects them all. In fact, action is happening from the top and the bottom all the time. And we can see how a lot of social and revolutionary processes, processes where there's a major change required, almost never comes from the top. It comes from the bottom. So that idea is quite built into lots of social change processes. But I think there's an interesting contrast to that, is that even though we are talking about fostering bottom-up action, or in the environment movement it's often been called local action, acting where you actually are, what is the local opportunity. And in the saying, thinking globally and acting locally, really means that we need the big picture view from above, the top-down view. And ironically, in our society, that has all disappeared, because that involves holistic thinking. Whereas what we have had is reductionist thinking, which is all looking at the small little pieces. So much of science is like this. So much of our ways of dealing with problems is all this bit reactivity. Whereas the ability to stand back and see the larger picture, think holistically, is not just something that's relevant for those who are managing corporations or governments. It's actually something we can all do. And when we have that that thinking globally, but we don't just try to manage things managerially, we accept we are just actually a small part of things, and we are not actually in control, but we can do something and see what happens next. But because we have the larger picture, we can understand the context or have some understanding of what's going on. And I think that is a very powerful new mode of thinking, which when it becomes universal, it will actually empower people to take control of their lives. So thinking globally, acting locally, or top-down thinking, bottom-up action, there's different ways of seeing it, is I think a very powerful idea. But it's difficult because almost all of our thinking is structured around this reductionist look at everything in small compartments. So permaculture is trying to overturn that with look at the big picture first. And one of the design principles is in fact design from patterns to details. Work from the larger scale patterns. And we do this very practically in designing a site for a house and garden. Lay out the larger patterns and fit in the details rather than trying to sort of deal with every little piece and then not understanding how it sort of fits into a larger whole.
So to expand on that, can you talk a bit about what systems, living systems theory is and what, how that relates to permaculture and
what that means? Well, systems theory through the 20th century has been quite an abstract field that's had enormous impacts in our world. It led to cybernetics and the computer revolution. It's the theory that allows us to run these enormous electricity grids where there are multiple sources of power and millions of users all in this pulsing way. But the broadest repertoire of systems is actually in nature, self-organizing systems. We call them ecosystems. And a large part of permaculture thinking comes from an approach to ecology called systems ecology, which unfortunately is generally not so widely taught in our universities. A lot of the ecology that's taught is actually reductionist biology and zoology, whereas systems ecology is looking at how do these systems work in a larger scale way.
That was part one of a two-part interview with David Holmgren, co-originator of the permaculture concept. I'm Velcro Ripper, and this was Fierce Light, where spirit meets action.
On Rabble Podcast Network.
Breathe in suffering. Breathe out compassion.